Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this special event recording, Andreas Kuhn of the Observer Research Foundation America joined Johanna Weaver and Jennifer Jackett to explore the ideas put forward in their recent paper from the QuadTech Networks QTN series. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Johanna Weaver. I've recently joined the Australian National University as the director of a new initiative here, the Tech Policy Design Centre. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to you today, the co-presenters of today's webinar. So we have Dr. Andreas Kuhn, who's a senior fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in America, where he leads research on international cybersecurity cooperation within the ORF's American Cyberspace Cooperative Initiative. His work focuses on the new risks and challenges in the international security at the intersection of emerging technology, cybersecurity, and technology governance. We also have with us here today Jennifer Jackett. He's a Sir Ronald Wilson Scholar and a PhD candidate at the National Security College. She is researching US-China competition for leadership over emerging technologies on the implications of that for US allies and partners. We're going to throw first for a short introduction from Andreas, who's going to be introducing the paper that he co-wrote with Tricia Ray from the Observer Research Foundation in India. So, Andreas, thank you so much for joining us. It's late where you are, so we appreciate it extra more. We'll pass to you to give us an introduction on the paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Johanna, and thank you, everyone, for being here today to talk about 5G security in the context of the Quad. I'm delighted to be here and also be part of this initiative. It has been fun and exciting and interesting to kind of contribute to the QTN series. At this point, I also should acknowledge my dear colleague, Tricia Ray, from the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, who have made significant contribution to this paper and has been a great co-author, but unfortunately is not able to join us today, so she will be missed. Again, the paper, I think 5G, we all have kind of like, I guess that's why we heard a lot about 5G and some of kind of like the challenges around them in a geopolitical context, and I think that's where this paper is coming in. So I think what we're trying to do in this paper is really to kind of like to argue and to identify kind of like the needs there, devise effective ways to kind of jointly manage risks and strengthen the resilience of 5G components, domestic and foreign networks, and global supply chains, kind of an efforts that the Quad should undertake. And we do this kind of like in multiple parts. And I think it's also important to understand where this paper fits in, knowing that the Quad has been working on 5G, identifying clear kind of low, if you want, low hanging fruits to address 5G security. I think that's where we started with. Recognizing that the importance of security of the ICT infrastructure, and in particular 5G, is important to kind of like, you know, benefit from the tremendous economic but also social benefits that 5G and other emerging technologies are promising. I think that's kind of like the starting point. And I think what we did, we kind of like try to taking stock on some of the different policy measures that different Quad countries have been undertaking and kind of broadly categorized them along like five categories, such as blocking high-risk vendors. We've seen like the US taking a very elaborate and probably the most aggressive approach there versus other Quad countries taking more like a soft ban, if you want, but nevertheless kind of a strict ban. Second category was about leveraging procurement and security requirements, kind of like what governments can regulate with when it comes to procuring on the government side, but also introducing new security requirements as part of that. I think we have seen quite a bit of changes in kind of like the way how procurement requirements can be leveraged to achieve that in all those countries. But also, for example, in the case of India, kind of like building into needs to kind of like procure made in India technology. Third kind of like important part that we saw is the imposing carrier security obligations. So kind of on the side of the carriers who run 5G technology, who buy those technologies, what they need to have in place in terms of cybersecurity and supply chain security. I think one interesting part there, I was found that quite fascinating, is Japan's approach that basically give away for free 5G spectrum in exchange to the promise that carriers are abiding to those cybersecurity requirements. You know, in the US, those spectrum allocation auctions kind of came up to like about $80 billion in revenue for the state. And here we had like took a slightly different approach. But also there were other examples providing financial incentives to industry for secure 5G deployments that Japan and the US were taking to kind of like incentivize the development and deployment of secure 5G solutions. But also, and last but not least, obviously, strengthening international cooperation as an important part that some of those countries have already been undertaken outside of the Quad before. There's like an MOU between Japan and India, for example, that also addresses 5G cooperation security. But obviously here, when you go to the later part of the paper, to understand how we can build this up to get broader on that. And I think the key part, and I think we'll not go into much detail here because I know Jen said she's going to go look into this in more detail later in the paper, is kind of like the risk and the resilience aspect of it. We came up with fairly three simple categories: technical risk, supply chain connectedness risk, and capability capacity risk, as kind of a basis to talk about how risk could be managed and how, when it comes to the recommendations, how this can be done within the Quad individually as for those countries, but also together in a kind of a joint Quad effort. I think I want to end here, but maybe also want to quickly note that the paper was written before the second Quad summit held in September, like about a little bit more than a month ago. So it's interesting to see that some of those ideas that we had kind of were started materializing them there, also kind of recognizing what we really tried to do in this paper is to come up with what are, you know, low-hanging fruits. There are obviously kind of like short-term and long-term recommendations and issues we can work on. I think the paper really tried to speak to kind of like those what stability in the Quad, what can the Quad achieve in that regard in the short term. I think that was kind of like the goal here. I'll stop here and does that work for you, Jen?
Yeah, that's great, Andreas. Thank you so much for that overview. I might start as well by offering some of my own reflections in response to the overview you provided, and then we can start to unpack perhaps a bit of the points of analysis. So I think, as we all know, 5G communications infrastructure will form the backbone of the modern digital economy, which your paper points out. And it will enable vast improvements in network speeds and support the connectedness of countless devices through the Internet of Things and also new applications like self-driving cars. I think in that context, this paper makes a really important contribution to public policy debates around the constructive role that the Quad can play in the sort of economic opportunities as much as the security that we can find in 5G networks at a very critical time in the rollout and deployment of this technology worldwide. as you mentioned, since the paper was written, we've also seen the leaders level Quad Summit in September. And it was very clear there that 5G and secure, open and transparent 5G was very much a priority for all countries and something that they're going to be pursuing through the Critical and Emerging Technology Working Group. I think as part of their communique, they said that they wanted to pursue opportunities like open radio access networks, which we'll talk a little bit later about in the discussion. And they also flagged that cooperation with the private sector was key, which is another theme we'll come back to. So I think in the context of where the Quad is going, your paper really helps to put some meat on the bones in terms of actionable and practical policy recommendations that Quad countries could really take forward to implement their 5G agenda and indeed even extend it to other countries in the Indo-Pacific and beyond over time. So before we get to some of those practical recommendations, it might be useful to take a step back to some of the sort of geostrategic and contextual factors that are driving Quad cooperation in this area. So the first issue I wanted to ask you about is the geopolitical dimensions of 5G security. What is the current sort of geopolitical context around 5G, especially from the perspective of Quad countries? And why is 5G actually significant in geopolitical terms?
I think that's a very, very good and I think fundamental question. I think it comes down to a particular moment in time where we are in right now, right? Kind of like this convergence of different technologies, recognizing the importance of emerging and critical tech for all kind of applications that you mentioned before. And I think 5G is kind of like one of them, but I think in many ways it's also an enabler of them because many other technologies, AI, cloud computing, IoT, other applications we build on top with some of those other technologies really will rely on 5G, right? So I think that's why we, from a technical perspective, think that the 5G is important, right? But I think the conversation, while, you know, when you think about a few, you know, in the beginning, I think this was much more focused on 5G as an issue that needs to be solved. I think in the interim, you know, we have seen the shift, if you want, to kind of a broader perspective on not only 5G, but critical and emerging technology, I think, which really needs to be recognized. And countries have come forward with, like, you know, Australia is one of their, it's one of the leading examples. And I know Joanna has been working on that over the past few years of coming up with strategies to actually address that. So I think that it's not only a one issue thing that is 5G, it's a broader set of issues that need to be addressed. And I think 5G, I think, is just the most prominent one. It's the one that kind of like was at the forefront of this. There is, as you said, an economic driver behind that, right? Kind of this understanding that if we innovate, if we invest in 5G, if we come up with new applications, this will have tremendous economic benefits. I think that's one part. But there also this kind of idea about, and that's a little bit less my strong suit, but kind of when it comes to defense and military applications, also there the question is like, we need to have this 5G for warfighting capabilities, even if we, you know, kind of depend on 5G infrastructure that might be, you know, deployed by or deployed in like what the military or DoD calls gray or red zones, right? So kind of how can we come up with approaches to operate in such an environment when some of the infrastructure might be compromised. So I think those are kind of like that's part of that answer. And you know, I think in the beginning this was a more narrow discussion about technical security, which I think, at least that's how I started with that. I think it pretty quickly for most observer became clear this is a broader question. It doesn't, maybe at this point it's hard to make an argument this question could be solved if we could completely address technical or cybersecurity, which we cannot, right? That's part of this game. There is no 100% assurance that this will be secure 100%. But we can do things to make things more secure, and I think that's an important aspect to recognize. As this is not only, I think there's this big the origin of the technology and whether or not that is an important aspect of whether or not it's secure. I think we should have strict and possibly high security requirements for the technology as well as for the supply chain that applies across all vendors. But I think, again, originally it's kind of like this conversation between China-based vendor versus non-China-based vendor, and a host on other policy issues or political issues and also geostrategic tensions that kind of informed that debate. And I know we could have a very long conversation about how this all fits together, but I think it I think I want to stop here because I don't want to go what I don't know what I don't want to take host this conversation on those things. But obviously it's important to also recognize that different countries, and I think maybe we can come back to this a little bit later, when it comes to the Quad, they come up with different policies. I mean, there are definitely certain shared interests, no questions, when it comes to perceived security threats from China, but different countries have different abilities to deal with them. When you think about the US has been doing this for a long time, their reaction and response to the 5G question has been prolonged, if you want, with very sophisticated and very holistic responses on all fronts. You know, when you go through all the laws that have been passed, new institutions have been proposed to address that issue. That is a different animal, if you want, than compared to some of the other countries. You know, Japan was pretty swift in their response and short, it seems, in comparison. So I think you see that have different tastes, how also big actors engage in those conversations and their ability to manage some of those expectations.
Yeah, fascinating. There's a lot of different issues there that I'm keen to unpack further. I guess just on the geopolitics of it, it really does seem like 5G in and of itself is significant given the economic and security dimensions, but also in that broader context of this contest for technological leadership that we are seeing unfolding, especially between the US and China, but perhaps between China, the US and its partners more broadly, that 5G really does seem to be one of those significant areas that could have ripple effects for other technological dimensions as well. Just coming back to areas of risk, perhaps before we get further into the approaches of different Quad countries, I think it was a really important point you raised around the fact that some of the early decisions, and we saw this in Australia's decision in 2018 to exclude high-risk vendors, the focus was very much on vendors as the way to mitigate risks. But I think your paper really makes clear that even with certain vendors excluded, there are still a number of areas of risk that need to be managed going forward, especially in relation to cybersecurity. And you do point out the technical risk, the supply chain risk, and the capability and capacity risk. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more to those dimensions of risk that countries will still need to grapple with within the Quad, even where they have excluded high-risk vendors from their networks.
Yeah, I'm more happy to do that and go into a little bit more detail of those different categories. I think, you know, in the beginning, the framing of why it's risky, it becomes from a certain country, I think seems problematic because the risk assessment from a technical perspective, right, it shouldn't matter where something is coming from, but it should be about the engineering. It should be about the secure development processes and the quality controls in place to ensure that software, hardware, products, and so forth are developed in a secure way. I think that's one part, but the other part also then comes down to how the things are deployed, right? Do the people or the organizations that are deploying those new technologies have the knowledge, the capacity to do this securely, right? And so I think there are multiple factors at play. I think for one, we have a novel technology, right? I think whenever we have something new, we might not know certain risks that come with them in terms of its deployment. What do we need to know? What do we need to address? That often takes time. I think we see this in other types of technologies. Technologies tend over time to become better and more secure. I think that's one part. The other part is kind of like this new the creation of all this new interconnectivity, right? We connect many more devices that have new forms of interactions that also create new interdependencies. If we think of you know, certain services that are deployed, build on others, and out of a sudden something maybe breaks, you know, for whatever reason, or is hacked or whatsoever, then you might up with interruption that have not been experienced before, because we kind of like form kind of like new interdependencies because of building technologies on top. So I think that's kind of like the general idea that, you know, if we just focus on particular vendors, we might not do ourselves a good service. I think we should raise kind of like the security requirements across all you know, players, if you want, right? With different players, you know, operators, vendors, to some degree, users have their accountability and need to do the right thing to get to the point. Let's briefly talk about those three risk categories. I think there's one like a kind of like classical one, that the technical risk, you know, risk inherent to 5G architecture and protocols. I think that's what I talked before earlier. Kind of like the but also the idea that that kind of like the core and the edge of the network is not so as separate anymore as it used to be in earlier technology generations, and so that has implications that we need to understand and need to be addressed. I think that's one part of that. I think you also mentioned ORAN, or Open Radio Access Network, as an example before, as another way to maybe address some of those issues when it's specific to a vendor. In this particular case, we can virtualize certain services that before were hardware based through a general purpose technology or computing technology, which then would allow new vendors come in, develop new technologies and so forth, which addresses some other issues we talked about earlier. But again, it's new technology. It might come up with new challenges that need to be addressed through the technology, but also the integration of many different vendors. Supply chain and connectedness risk, I think all through COVID, we all experienced what it means outside of the 5G domain, right? There are bottlenecks when it comes to suppliers, bottlenecks when it comes to all type of inputs along the supply chain. We have seen, particularly in the COVID-19 context, kind of the weaponization of trade to kind of like further particular political goal. You know, you could think about like a scenario where something like that could be the case also in the 5G context. I think in some sense, the US response to some of them kind of like curtailing access to the Chinese company is in some ways, is kind of like a similar mechanism that could be deployed in such a way in a trade representation context. Then I think that an important part that I think we have not really talked about as much, I think the first two categories are probably more clear, or we often talk about, is really kind of like, do we have the capability and capacity to manage risk in this new context, right? Do we have the institution built up to do that? And again, this is about, kind of like, do all the people deploying 5G, are they up to code? Are they following best practice? And, you know, you can think of like large ICT companies, telecommunication providers that know how to do this and are on top of their game. But we also have like a lot smaller telecommunication service providers or carriers that might have more difficulty to adjust to that, particularly in the beginning. We see new deployment scenarios, 5G for 5G networks. Right before, we had like mostly carriers providing communication services with 5G. There are scenarios where a university or a stadium might operate their own 5G networks. Do they have the capacity to manage risks, for example? So that's one of the questions. But I think an interesting point, and I think I mentioned that earlier, is also on an international political diplomatic level, right? Do we have people in State Departments and Ministry of Foreign Affairs who speak 5G and cybersecurity to talk about issues around norms, for example, to have those conversations? I think that we have seen that in the context of clean network initiative, for example, bringing up those issues to partners and talk about that, not from a technical perspective, but in a political context. And I think that's also kind of like part of this capacity and capability risk that needs to be addressed.
And in terms of those three areas of risk, which I thought was a really useful way of framing what the issues are, coming back to how Quad countries actually assess these risks, is there much alignment or perhaps even areas of divergence between the Quad countries? Because I guess it's how these nations view things from a technical perspective and what the appropriate mitigations might be that actually lend itself to closer cooperation or not. So in that stock take that you did, which was really helpful, what's the state of play across the Quad countries and the level of commonality between them?
That's a good question. You know, I think when I think about kind of risk assessment, I try to kind of like looking for a table, right, that kind of like really spells out what those risks are and how they are assessed and what the potential impact is, as well as how they're mitigated, right? And in an earlier version of the paper, you know, we tried to kind of find those four different Quad countries. And that's unfortunately, you know, not necessarily in the public domain on the there's general risks, you know, that we're often talk about, you know, but kind of like more specific risks or frameworks are maybe a little bit less available, which would have been interesting to actually kind of better understand, you know, or policy statements are available, right? Kind of like while something is risky, we don't want, for example, a foreign interference in our net critical infrastructure network or foreign interference in our political processes or into society, right? But kind of like, so I think more high level statements are available, but kind of some of the detail why certain decisions were taken, maybe how this could be addressed, we didn't really find them, which would have been helpful to maybe understand why you know, certain measures were taken. I think in some ways, the measures that were taken largely also reflect the legal and regulatory authorities that countries have available, right? I think in the U.S., when you again, there are many laws have been passed, many regulatory decisions have been taken. When you go through that, it's quite interesting. It's almost like an archaeology of the regulatory state and its powers to kind of like address those issues. And I think that was fascinating. So I think, you know, we try to kind of like compare kind of the measures that have been taken with those kind of five main categories, right? Kind of like the that I mentioned at the very beginning, the blocking high-risk vendors, leveraging procurement security requirements, imposing carrier security obligations. And I think those are kind of very common. I think they are all in their different flavors. I think that's a kind of like a natural way to regulate technologies, and maybe also similar things that states have done in the past. Where we found differences, I think later in the game, you know, the U.S. also brought in kind of like financial incentives to foster local secure 5G development, particularly with ORAN, but also put aside some money in what is called the Multilateral Telecom Fund to kind of foster international cooperation in that space. And in the case of Japan, they put aside, made some tax incentives available also, again, with the idea to foster secure development. And I think here in the case of Japan, and I think that's also true, I think in the case of the US, there are clear economic incentive for their national industries who are leaders in this space to kind of like come up with solutions. The US so far has no provides 5G components to, but doesn't have like, you know, Ericsson or Nokia or Samsung, for example, stations, as compared to Japan that has kind of local players there.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think that leads nicely into the second substantive part of the conversation, which is really around how the Quad countries can work more closely together on 5G issues. And this gets to really the heart of what you're proposing in your paper. So I might ask you to just very briefly give the high-level summary of those recommendations, and then I'm really keen to unpack those, especially for policymakers listening in, so they can understand how to operationalize some of these ideas going forward.
Yeah, happy to do that. And I think, again, as I said before, you know, we kind of like finished that up before the Quad Summit, so it's, I can't claim that they took all this from our paper, but there are obviously some commonalities, which is good to hear. Sometimes wonder, oh, maybe we have not been forward-thinking enough that they addressed quite a few of them. But I think in essence, right, we came up with like five key recommendations that we felt are pretty kind of like are immediate or need to be addressed. So one is kind of the need to conduct a joint risk assessment of 5G supply chains, including scenarios for common threat vectors and define mitigation measures for vendors and operators. The second recommendation was to define common standards for what trustworthy behavior should look like for 5G vendors and equipment providers. This in the context of like what is trustworthy, which is kind of like, as we talked about earlier, just the origin of a product or of a vendor where someone is based might be not good enough. And I think we've seen that in the SolarWinds incident in the US, that you know, if a trusted vendor is compromised, then this is problematic. So I think there's also like this move in the cybersecurity discussion towards zero trust, right? Kind of like the need to an ongoing continuous verification of technology to ensure its security. Establish a 5G agenda for the Quad under the Critical and Emerging Technologies Working Group. I think that seems to be straightforward. Looking at the statement that came out on September 24th, I think that's on its way. But we have not heard too much details about how that looks like. And if you actually have more insights into that, I'm curious to hear if you heard any more details on that. The fourth is the recommendation with regards to coordinated policy priorities in international forums on ICT securities and standard setting. Again, here kind of like UN cyber norms, cyber stability, responsible state behavior in cyberspace. Is there something that can be done? But also more on the technical side, technical standard setting. Often there's always this point to China that allegedly kind of like has been maybe playing the process towards their benefit. And so the question comes up: oh, could and should like-minded states, maybe take a page from that book and say maybe we should talk and have coordination meetings and talk about what could be done in that field. And five is kind of the need to build a multi-stakeholder 5G resilience alliance. And here again, like on one side, kind of the emphasis on multi-stakeholder, the emphasis on beyond the Quad, right? This is an effort that needs to be broader than just the Quad. And also, again, it's about resilience. So how can we move the conversation from just security to resilience? Because, you know, things will happen. That's what security is about. It's never 100%, but the question about how we can respond to that. And happy to talk to resilience a little bit more later. But I think that's why we felt strongly about talking about resilience in the broader context beyond the Quad.
Fantastic. I'm conscious that time seems to be getting away from us. So I'm going to ask one question that I think is essential to all of those recommendations before I throw back to Johanna and the audience questions. My question is really around the role of private industry in all of these initiatives. I think we've seen a strong emphasis on public-private cooperation by Quad leaders. And in the Australian context, there's actually been a lot of work done over the last 5 years or so to establish very close relationships relationships between relevant cyber agencies in government and private owners and operators of critical infrastructure to try and mitigate some of these risks. How do you see private industry being a partner in some of the ideas that you've put forward?
I think that's a very good question, right? I think at the end of the day, this technology is mostly operated and bought by the private sector. I think it's clear that government, is there to set certain, guidelines, policy guidelines, how the playing field should look like. But then at the end of the day, it's the private sector that develops those technologies, that deploys those technologies, that also should ultimately secure those technologies. I think it's their responsibility, and so I think that's why the private sector has been front of center in those developments and in those conversations. I think we have seen a lot of good points around how governments can set incentives for private sector to then do certain things, right? I'm still at times, while there certainly are, within the Quad, different corporations collaborating on 5G developments, Japan, US semiconductor field related to 5G. This was one example. How much can that be steered by just government setting certain targets or providing certain financial incentives? So I think that's why understanding how those environments look like is an important part of the governments to be able to actually come up with good measures and moving forward this conversation. But in order to do that, this can again only be done in close cooperation with the private sector.
And they're also key to the idea that you have around engagement in standard setting organizations too. In fact, industry really leads a lot of the engagement in some of those bodies like 3GPP, for example. Yeah. All right. I'll go back to Johanna now to ask some audience questions.
Thank you, Jen. If you have a question, please raise your hand or pop it into the chat and we will call on you. We have one question that has come through, which I think is actually deceptive in its simplicity, Andreas, so stand by. But it is a question about what does the 5G discussion, and particularly I think when we talk about the security dimensions, the economic dimensions, and we talk about 5G as being the critical infrastructure of critical infrastructure, but what do these discussions actually mean when it comes down to the average, the question that's been put by Dr. Amanda Watson is to the average mobile phone user, but I might expand that and say, why is this an important question for citizens, for the average person on the street? Why should we care about these issues?
That's a very good question, right? Because I think we have all had this probably experience that we talk with friends and colleagues about, oh, what are you doing? I work in 5G, and then you get the idea that that's not top of on their mind, or it's hard to understand why this matters. In fact, right, in order to really benefit from that, I have to buy another new expensive phone. Why do I want to do that? I think at the end of the day, right. Well, I think we have to put in the broader context and it comes down to those kind of difficult value discussions that we're having around not only 5G but emerging critical technologies. Want to do the right things in this field. I think that's part of that. So I think it's not particularly tangible. We can always look into the future and say how this will enable new applications. In fact, you can make a point around how COVID-19, if you would have not have all this technology in place, how responses, the ability to work from home, international cooperation on vaccine development would have been probably close to impossible. So I think that's part of a broader argument around how technology can help address societal challenges. How to break it down to the individual, I think that's actually a pretty tough one. But I'm curious, maybe Jen or Joanna, maybe you have a good, I'm curious if you have a good answer to that.
Well, look, I think when it comes to looking at these issues, given the way that technology is embedded into all of our lives, being able to actually harness the opportunity in a country like Australia, for example, good 5G means that you can access telehealth from a remote area and access good medical care that you might not otherwise be able to. It enables you to get from A to B the most efficiently, or to get your mail delivered. There's so many different applications to this, but of course that isn't useful for us if it isn't secure. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily that every single element of that needs to have 100% security, and I think you're absolutely right that 100% security actually doesn't exist. So it's about pinpointing what are the things that we need to protect and to prioritise the protection of what are the pieces of critical infrastructure that all of the other pieces of critical infrastructure depend upon. And I think that's where the 5G conversation really comes in focus. Jen, did you have anything you wanted to add there before I jump on to the next question?
The only thing I'd add to that is, I guess, from an individual user perspective, there's also important considerations around things like privacy of data and sort of the ethical considerations that might go into the programming of certain technologies. So there are some additional considerations too, but I think that comes back to your point around how do we actually prioritize what's important for these technologies and focus on mitigating the most important risks. But from a citizen perspective, I imagine those issues are front and center when it comes to some of these critical and emerging technologies.
I really like both of your answers a lot. You know, I think there's also now I remember, you know, I think in Australia there was also quite a bit of a controversy about the health implication of 5G, right? So I think there is definitely kind of like if I'm not mistaken, right, Australia had kind of a bit of a maybe misinformation issue on some of the things, or was maybe more prominent, at least how I was told, compared to other countries on the issue. Not that this did not happen elsewhere anyways, but, you know, and I think those are important aspects to address besides only security, kind of like the broader benefits that not only 5G, but I think the entire set of these emerging technologies will bring in what 5G enables.
So, Andreas, I have I'm waiting for more audience questions. Please throw them in. But whilst we wait for someone to type madly, I wanted to throw one question to you in terms of the norm setting conversation. This is obviously something very dear to my heart, having been involved in the conversations on responsible state behaviour at the United Nations. In those discussions, supply chain was actually one of the most sensitive issues. And in fact, if you had have asked people at the start, the middle and the end what they thought was going to be the issue that would prevent us from being able to reach consensus, and, you know, these discussions involved the US, they involved China, they involved Russia, so you've got everyone at the table. So when you talk about norm setting in that environment, is there something in particular that you think it's possible for us to do at that international norm setting level, as distinct from, for example, you mentioned earlier the clean pipe initiative that the US has kicked off, but also things like the Prague 5G conference and the proposals that they have there. I think there are different conversations to be had at the UN level when we have everyone involved, and then smaller groups that are still inclusive, and then your smaller coalitions like the Quad. Are there different things that you think we should be aiming for in each ones of those discussions?
That's a very good question. I think probably the answer is yes. But I think that, you know, kind of like understanding where those processes are and what could be a good tailored norm or an action item that the group should work on. I think that figuring that out is probably kind of like part of the what it would be a good response here, right? You know, I think I was surprised in a positive way that we had supply chain addressed in those UN conversations. I think it showed, you know, kind of like a broader recognition. You know, I think it's whenever experts talk about the things, and then you think, oh, we have been talking about this for years, but nobody listens to us. But it's important. Why are you not listening? And then those things all of a sudden start popping up at certain places, such as the UN Arms process, and things. Oh, if those people are paying attention, then I think that's probably a good thing. So I think the need to raise awareness on those issues. You know, I remember when I first started working on this, I think somewhere around 2016, back at the East-West Institute, we had like this ICT buyer's guide that really tried to make the case why third-party risks are important, how they could be addressed. I remember having had conversation with like large ICT companies who didn't feel like that should be part of in the US NIST cybersecurity framework, that there should not be, you know, is already covered elsewhere. And so I was kind of, and I think we've come a long way in this conversation to actually point out third-party risk as an issue. There were times, and there was not that long ago, where we didn't talk about that. So I think that development is an important part. Again, I think awareness in the UN is great. When it comes to actual implementation, we all know, and you probably know the best of all of us, how difficult it is to come to a point not only to agree or adapt kind of to some consensus reports or a particular norm, but then kind of go to the next step and have countries implement them or to adhere to those norms, right? And I think that's where other forums, the Quad among others, could come in and maybe kind of take an aspect that has been agreed upon, such as the norms, and come up with concrete guidance how that could be done. I think that will be a great kind of contribution that the Quad could do with regards to those UN cyber norms. But I think other industry associations, you know, norm settings, kind of like making sure this is tied together to some of those larger conversation, but also ensuring that you know, we don't try to solve the same problem multiple times in hopefully incompatible ways, right? So coming up with coordinating amongst those core organizations would be important. Reciprocity of certification, for example, you know, to speed up security certification of products and services, for example, would be another aspect that could be mentioned there. I think to make the answer short, it really comes down to what four are we talking about, and then come up with very concrete actions that they could undertake.
Thanks, Andreas. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's always going to be a difficult exercise to be able to get agreement to norms. And actually, you know, the most recent, for example, group of governmental experts on cyber issues at the UN agreed recommendations around supply chain that include things like legislative protections around privacy and data protection, to Jen's point, included calls not to have harmful hidden functions, to have cybersecurity by design through the life cycle of a product as well. These are things that, you know, all countries can agree to, but then it's the question of, well, how, when it comes to implementation, and when countries then implement that in a way that comes into some of those geopolitical divides and questions that we were talking about earlier. That's where I think there's a lot of challenge. So I can see Will Stoltz has his hand up, but sorry, Will, just because this question that we have here flows very neatly into the point we were just raising, I might just go to this question and then come to you, Will. So this is a question from Claire, and she's asking, are there any examples in Quad countries or elsewhere where you're seeing particularly successful 5G standards and frameworks being implemented? And I think that goes to that point of, we can agree at the high level, but how do we actually implement it?
You know, that's a good question. So I think we probably have to clarify what we're talking about here, right? There are, you know, some of those frameworks would be, you know, broader than just as 5G, but for example, in the US, kind of cybersecurity risk framework, right, that would adopt some of them, would address some of those issues in a very high level, and then have like a range of activities around that. You know, I think the US, I'll bring this up as an example because I know this particularly well, is has undertaken a range of issues with pretty tight multi-stakeholder involvement, mostly from industry, you know, among carriers, among technology providers, not only specific to 5G, but also ICT more broadly. If it comes to, I think the challenge always is, you know, as an observer, when it comes to deployment and how, you know, certain particular actors do those things, it's a little bit more complicated to get access to some of this information. And even kind of like getting a sense where the deployment, the current deployment of 5G is not that straightforward. You know, you hear a lot of like press releases, what's all happening, what sounds good. But then when it really comes down to what does it mean for the users? This can be kind of tricky to come by this type of information. Or at least when we did this research and were looking into that, that was more difficult than expected, and which was a challenge. You know, so I think, to be sure, I don't have a particularly good answer to that. I think there's a lot of good case studies where different countries did things. Different companies have been put forward. Some of those technologies implemented that. You know, they are there to use. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a good answer to your question.
Thanks, Andreas. I think given how much research you have done, that is interesting that there is not that information available, and perhaps a little bit concerning. So Will, we'll pass to you now to put your question.
Thanks, Johanna, and thanks all for a really fascinating conversation this afternoon. Andreas, I wanted to get your reaction to a kind of recent event in this space in relation to Australia. You might have seen the Telstra purchase of Digicel, the kind of big backbone of mobile connectivity in the Pacific region. I'm interested to get your reaction to this idea of quad countries, or in this case, at least Australia, kind of encouraging and using private industry in this way, and whether you think the Quad is actually an entity to do this type of behavior in a more coordinated fashion, or whether there are perhaps risks in, you know, liberal democratic free market countries kind of leveraging big telecommunications providers in this way.
Telstra Digicel case, you know, that was kind of interesting to hear, given kind of like some of the current challenges or tension at play. It was not surprising that you know, Australia wanted to do something in this space. I could imagine that maybe other partners might have had conversations around that maybe Australia should do something. I don't know. That's just me speculating. I could imagine that given current tension in the Pacific, having, I think, the largest mobile provider in the Pacific not go to a Chinese company, I think seems to be something that governments do consider. You know, so I was not I was not surprised that this came up as a policy decision to pursue that. It would be interesting to see, you know, I think, do we set a precedent for that? Emerging critical tech infrastructure that something needs to be done about, right? I've also seen, and I thought it was an interesting argument, which was about you know, Australia being a fairly liberal market economy, but this is not, I think my understanding is this was not the first time that this happened, right? It's like there is also the case of undersea cable that Australia, I think in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, kind of did a similar transaction. Australia started to reconfigure some of the financing mechanisms around doing such types of transactions. I think what I'm curious is about, you know, will there be more of that? I think that's one question. And then I think you had a spot on good idea. You know, could the Quad potentially in coordination pursue similar activities moving forward? I think that's an interesting question. I don't have a good answer to that. I think there's a lot of other, you know, kind of issues that need to be figured out. Who pays for what? Who does the thing belong to at the very end? Who takes some responsibility? My understanding is that the Australian government, you know, provides financial support in that sense, but the ownership is clearly with Telstra. I think there's a lot of interesting questions around that, but I think it's also this time and moment, right, that we have given those tensions, that this seems to be, from a national security point of view, kind of an understandable move. Whether or not it makes economic sense, this might be a different assessment.
Thanks, Andreas. So I think I'll just add one additional consideration there is, you're absolutely right, Australia has been involved in the subsea cables back a couple of years, but actually we've had quite a long history of being involved in the communication sector for many countries in the Pacific, for example, through satellite connectivity, etc. And there's actually a large development agenda there, as well as the economic and the national security considerations, which is something else that we are considering. For those of you who are interested in the question around the infrastructure and how we support the communications infrastructure, I would also commend to you the another one of the Quad papers, the Techno Diplomacy Strategy for Telecommunications in the Indo-Pacific, which was Lisa Curtis and Martin Rasser. So that's another of this series of papers, which talks about some of these issues that we've been discussing. So encourage you to get on the NSC website and have a look at those. Andreas, thank you so much. I'm going to pass now to Jen to wrap up the session now, but it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Johanna. So before we conclude today's really fascinating conversation, I wanted to warmly invite you to register for the final webinar that we have in the Quad Tech Network series, and that will be on biotechnology issues in the Indo-Pacific on the 15th of November from 6 till 7 p.m. So a perfect sort of pre-dinner conversation for you to get your teeth into. And that will be with Dirk van der Klee from the ANU, as well as Dr. Will Stoltz and myself. And the registration for that is still open on the National Security College website. Once again, I'd really like to thank both Andreas and Johanna as co-hosts of today's conversation, and to Andreas and Tricia in particular for the really important contribution that they made through their paper to this series. We really look forward to seeing you again at future events, and thank you so much for your engagement and questions throughout. Thanks, everyone. Have a great afternoon.
That's it for today. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.